The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This is the best of the Eric Metaxas Show.
It's the show everyone's talking about.
But they really should be listening to it.
Broadcasting from the Empire State Building because the Chrysler Building wasn't available.
This is the Eric Metaxas Show.
With your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey, I'm Eric Metaxas. Maybe you already knew that, but what you might not have known is that this week I am actually not at all in the Empire State Building, not even in New York. I'm across the pond. No, not in New Jersey. In England. Yes, I'm in Oxford, England right now doing a special series of Socrates in the City events. That's Socrates in the City. And I wanted to share them with you, my radio audience. So now let's listen in to the Socrates in the City event I did yesterday, or it may have been the day before. I'm getting confused with the jet lag, but very recently. I hope you enjoy it. Pip, pip, cheerio, and so on and so forth. Thank you.
Welcome to Socrates in the City, Oxford edition. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I cannot tell you how excited I am about this, not just because we're here in Oxford, but particularly because for me this is a dream come true. For years, I have wanted to interview Walter Hooper. And I never wanted to interview him just once. I want to interview him in a series, Nixon, David Frost style, not quite, but to really get, you don't get that reference? You're all kids. To really get into some depth, because he has such a wealth of information to share about his life and about C.S. Lewis and Lewis's works. There's no one who can compare. So please, Socrates in the City, welcome for Walter Hooper. It's in all of his fiction, this idea of embodying nobility, embodying vulgarity and baseness, that these things are not what we say they are. They're innate qualities, that God has created a universe with these innate qualities. Of course, the idea of maleness and femaleness is being challenged today, as though anyone can be anything, as though there isn't even such a thing as maleness. But the way Lewis portrays kings and queens, that they're very different in his world. Maybe you can talk a bit about gender or that kind of thing in his books, because it seems to be so strong, and it's maybe why some people don't want to read him these days.
Well, they may not, but there are enough who do. But I think it was natural that he called the king of the beast. The king of, named the one who rules Narnia after the king of the beasts, lion. You can't have a platypus, you know.
But that's, the funny thing is we know that. Most people would know that. But then you have to say, well, why? And it's just because it's something innate that we know. Platypus, that's very good. It's a great contrast.
But he was very, very fond of mice. He really loved them. Beautiful little quadrupeds. So he said that, if you may remember that scene in That Idiot's Strength, where after he finished, Ransom had finished having his tea, and the crumbs fell on the floor, the cake crumbs. He blew a little whistle, and these mice came out and consumed them. He said, we want to get rid of the crumbs. The mice need food. Why not do that? And so remember, it's the mice who eat the ropes off Aslan to help free him, you know, at the end. So he gives them a very noble purpose. And of course, one of his great characters is Reaper Cheep.
One of the greatest. The mice, you know. Yeah, Reba Cheap is one of the greatest. We were talking with Michael Ward the other day about Reba Cheap at the end of the Dawn Treader, getting into this little coracle and rowing away nobly, beautifully up the standing wave and into Aslan's country.
Aslan's own country.
One of the most beautiful literary images in the history of literature, I think. And given to a mouse, a noble mouse named Reba Cheap. Now, Reba Cheap's another one. All these names, I could just talk for days about the names. Reba Cheap, where did he get the name Reba Cheap?
I think it just sounds exactly right for this noble and martial mouse, you know. So, I mean, he must have just come up with something that sounds exactly right, you know.
Well, because Reba Cheap, we think of peep, you know, the way mice squeak, peep, Reba Cheap. The only person I can think of who does the same kind of thing is, of course, Lewis's very dear friend, Tolkien. Masterful. And it also has something to do with the idea that both of them had a very deep sense of language and etymology. The idea that Tolkien even invented a language that he that's very interesting to me, that words, the roots of words were important to them. The names of giants, I can't remember now. Nimble, I don't remember the name. But the giants' names, they're just perfect. They're not forbidding. They're friendly giants.
But I think the difference is they would have known between Tolkien's names and Lewis's names in Narnia. Narnia is really supposed to be a special place where you like going. It is not as as serious a place as Middle Earth.
No.
And you would not find Lewis using anything that is, I mean, as powerful as Nazgul.
As what?
Nazgul. You know, the flying kings, you know. I mean, that just sends shivers down your mind, especially in the context of the story. But Lewis is a world for children, too. And they, you know, there are more happy endings there. Though I think one of the things that they do share in their different stories is that they unwind the story upwards. There are many places in the Lord of the Rings where he could have ended just by saying, you know, the ring is destroyed, and that's it, and that's all, you know, they lived happily ever after. But he, you know, he knows that's not the way the world wags. So Frodo goes home, and you know, with Sam Gamgee, and they find things much changed, you know. So they have to deal with it changed, but then it's still a good ending, but not the quick ending. And Lewis is even better than anybody, I think, in that. He destroys in front of these children who love Narnia so much. He destroys it at the end because he knows you cannot rely on anything in this world to last. Not even Narnia. And so they go through the stable door into the real Narnia that lasts forever. But it's heartbreaking. After reading it 50 times, my heart is broken every time.
Well, that's, again, just to say it over and over again, his power as a writer, the power of his imagination, it's simply without peer. In my understanding, my estimation. I didn't want to forget to ask, you must have known J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about him? He died in 73. Yes. You came here in 63 and then in 64 for good. Did you, any memories of him?
This is a special Oxford edition of the Eric Metaxas Show. There's more of this conversation with Professor Walter Hooper coming up next.
Change in the weather. I get this feeling whenever it's and gray. Color is gone from everything.
Crazy little train in Cochabamba takes you for a ride that's quite a thrill. This crazy little train's a choo-choo-cha-cha.
You're listening to a special version of the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm doing a Socrates in the City event in Oxford, England. Let's continue my conversation with Professor Walter Hooper.
You must have known J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about him? He died in 73.
Yes.
You came here in 63 and then in 64 for good. Any memories of him and his estimation of Lewis, did it change at all in his last years?
No, I don't think so. I think Humphrey Carpenter is wrong, and A.N. Wilson are wrong to talk about them becoming cold towards one another. I saw nothing of this at all. I mean, when I first met him, he invited me to see him, and he was living at that time here in Oxford. And he was using his garage as a study. And when you went in, he said, "You've got 30 minutes." And he put up one of the big alarm clocks in front of me. And, you know, you could see here. You could hear it in the next room. It was tick, tick, tick. And so he said, "You've got 30 minutes." And so he did most of the talking himself. And at one point, he was talking still. He left. He said, stay where you are. And I stayed where I was. And he came in through another door. So I missed something of what he said. But anyway, I was so worried about the clock. And tick, 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 tick. So finally, he was in the middle of telling me something about Lewis when I said, "It's half an hour." He said, "Sit still. I am the lord of the clock. I'll tell you when you can go." Then when he led me to the door, he could not have been more tender. He held my arm and he said, "I'm so sorry. You've lost your great friend." And I said, "But you've lost one who you knew much longer." He said, "No, what makes your case much sadder than mine is you were just beginning to love him."
Oh.
So he said, "I've had many years, but you ought to be pitied."
Mm.
Anyway, I found that after that, he could not have been nice in talking about Lewis. He, one time when I was editing, I showed him some of the letters I was editing from Lewis to Arthur Greaves. 1929, he said to Arthur Greaves that he and Tolkien stayed up till very, very late as he was reading some of the Middle Earth documents, you know. So I assume this was The Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Professor Tolkien, "Was this The Lord of the Rings that you read?" "Oh, no, no," he said. "You see, no story had been written. I wasn't really interested in writing stories. I was interested in creating a world. And so it was the language and the genealogies and the land that I was interested in, not stories. But you know what a boy Jack Lewis was. He had to have a story, and that story, The Lord of the Rings, was written to keep him quiet."
Wow.
I think he meant it, too, you know, because there are letters of his which bear this out.
But the very idea that the genesis of this juggernaut called The Lord of the Rings, L-O-T-R, would have begun in that way, it's extraordinary. And what a strange thing that someone like Tolkien could be made in such a way that he would desire to create a world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What a strange thing. Most of us aren't that way, but that led to all these other things and to a billion-dollar industry.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
But I gave him, you know, here's a telling thing about him. In 1971, I had finished God in the Dark, and I gave him a copy of that. And he
that's the collection of essays.
A collection of essays.
God in the Dark, a collection of essays. Lewis effectively defending the Christian faith.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, Tolkien said, do you know, Jack Lewis is the only friend I've ever had who's written more since he died than before. And I said, I know exactly what you mean, and exactly the same will happen to you. He said, no, it won't. No, it won't, because I don't have that much material, and Christopher won't know what to do. Wow, was he wrong? He was stupendously wrong about that.
Had the Silmarillion been published before his death?
Oh, no, he really worried a lot about that. And, you know, I heard him, I've got to get finished. So he really worried about that, but I think he simply was just too old to get out the manuscripts and try to do it. But he loved Lewis very much, and I think he would have been appalled by what others said about this getting cold. In fact, his son, Father John Tolkien, told me that he took his father up there to Lewis, to see Lewis, right before Lewis died. A number of visits he paid up there to the Kills to see him. And I said to John Tolkien, do you know what they talked about? He said, I remember they talked about Malory's Mort d'Arthur and whether trees ever die.
Malory's Mort d'Arthur. That seems just what you'd imagine they would talk about, and whether trees ever die.
Yeah.
Not in their books, they don't. Remind those of us who don't know who Arthur Greaves was, because you've mentioned him a number of times.
This is Lewis's boyhood friend. They met when they were just teenagers. They lived across the road from one another. They built up not only a friendship, but a correspondence, which is one of the longest of all Lewis's correspondence. It was a great pleasure at that time to have somebody who is absolutely on your wavelength that you can correspond with.
Did he become, Arthur Greaves, a Christian?
He was a Christian already.
He was already.
Yeah.
Well, this brings me to when we mentioned Tolkien. It's not been told often enough, but what happened, Lewis had become somehow a reluctant believer in God, but not a believer in Jesus, not a Christian by any means, but a believer in some kind of God. And it was Tolkien specifically who, on Addison's Walk behind Magdalen College right here, who really led Lewis. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, you see, Lewis had become a theist, but then something like a year or more later, one of the things that was holding him back for many years was something that happened when he was really about 10 years old. When he was reading the classics for the first time, he noticed that the editors of the classics, like Homer and the Aeneid, you know, assumed that the beliefs of these ancient Greeks were wrong, you know, but that Christianity was right. Well, Lewis himself loved the old myths more than he liked Christianity. And so he concluded Christianity, it just happens to be the mythology that we've been brought up in. But other mythologies are, in one way, more interesting, like the Norse mythology, he thought more interesting than Christianity. So it was still in the belief that it was a mythology, that he believed that night that Tolkien and Hugo Dyson came to dine. Well, what they mainly showed him was, yes, it is a mythology like the others, but the others are incomplete. They never lead anywhere. But the thing that makes this less beautiful than the other Norse mythology, Greek mythology, and all that, is true. This is a case of myth becoming fact. And he suddenly saw that. It was a myth come true. And because it is truth, it cannot shine, you know, the way Norse mythology does, or Greek mythology, you know, with gods and giants and all of these wonderful things, you know. And but then it's true. And so it offers hope for the world.
This is a special Oxford edition of the Eric Metaxas Show. There's more of this conversation with Professor Walter Hooper coming up next.
Together, 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 having a ball. Having a ball. Taking care of business. Taking care of business. Taking care of business. Together.
Welcome back. You're listening to a special British version of the Eric Metaxas Show. I hope you're enjoying it. Here's more of my conversation with Professor Walter Hooper.
And remember, you know, people ask me, why didn't Tolkien push hard for him to become a Catholic? Well, see, he'd known him a long time. He was happy for him to become a Christian at all.
Mm. And well, so, but most people don't know that what an idea that these two giants of 20th century literature would have been walking with their third friend, Hugo Dyson, on Addison's Walk, having this conversation, because it would clearly take someone of such long-standing friendship as Tolkien, and really of, I mean, it goes with the friendship, but the idea that he respected him so deeply on these issues, that it would take someone like that to sort of tip him over. It still took a number of days. I guess this was germinating in his mind. And then suddenly in the sidecar of Warnie's motorcycle on the way to the Whipsnade Zoo, the penny drops and he says, I believe Jesus was the Son of God. I don't know if it's 9 days later or something, but the idea that it was J.R.R. Tolkien who brought it over. It's one of those delightful stories of history. It's one of the few of all these kinds of stories that's not apocryphal. It's absolutely true.
Well, I think those two men, of all the men I've ever known, and of all the Inklings, I think they still had, they were very adult men, but they had a children's heart. They still rejoice in beautiful, real, wonderful things. I mean, Christianity still excited them in a way it ceases to excite most adult converts, you know. They still cared a lot. They still saw things with the eyes of a child.
They could see the beauty. It's what you were saying about myths. Why? I mean, I guess it's in Surprised by Joy that Lewis talks about the line from Longfellow, Balder the Beautiful is dead, and how it just touched his heart, and he felt this yearning for northernness, for something. I mean, the idea that he was in touch with those feelings, that's not some hyper-materialist rationalist. That's somebody who's in touch with his feelings, with his inner child, to use that cliche. And it's why I think he was able to re-enchant people with his his stories, because we need that. And if the Christian faith is just syllogisms and rational theological points, then it's a reduced Christian faith. And I think it's, you know, one of the arguments for a more sacramental, incarnational, liturgical understanding of the Christian faith. I'm not saying specifically Catholic, but it's, to me, part of why Lewis is so multidimensional, because he can write, on the one hand, simple apologetics, but then he can give us the other side, the stained glass and the beauty and the statuary. So Well, I wanted, before we finish, just to go back to Lewis's use of language and how he could use words and come up with words. You were saying earlier that in the Narnia books, it was, you know, mainly for children, so he wanted to be this delightful, wonderful world, and so he didn't create anything too horrific or forbidding or malevolent. I mean, the White Witch is malevolent enough, but in the Space Trilogy, he does. And there are things in that hideous strength which are chilling. There are things in the other two books that are chilling, really chilling. And I thought, that's not often talked about, how Lewis was able to create evil, not to create evil, but to create a semblance of evil. And his choice of names in I guess, is it Perelandra or Out of the Silent Planet, where they see the Sorns?
That's Out of the Silent Planet.
Out of the Silent Planet. But when he describes the Sorn and gives it the word Sorn, I've never been so frightened. I thought, it's amazing that he has the power, but even to invent the name Sorn, such a strange, horrifying name. Can we guess where he got that from? I don't know.
Just his imagination.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I guess sometimes they do
mean,
that.
Fiffle Trigi as well. You
know? What's that?
Fiffle Trigi is one of the three three species they are.
It's pronounced Fiffle Trigi?
Fiffle Trigi.
Now I can die because I've always wondered. Fiffle Trigi.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Fiffle Trigi. Are there any vowels in there?
They make, useless things.
Yeah.
I said, what kind of useless things would you think they would make? He said, back scratchers.
Lewis said this. So you heard Lewis pronounce the word Fiffle Trigi.
Yeah, yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, there you have it, the horse's mouth. That is amazing. And then the Mal-Eldild, all of that, his ability to imagine these levels of being, and there is something medieval Catholic about it, this idea that it's not just us and Jesus. No, there are these intermediaries, there are angels, there are thrones and dominions. He creates that in the world, specifically of Perelandra.
This is a special Oxford edition of the Eric Metaxas Show. There is more of this conversation with Professor Walter Hooper coming up next. This is the Eric Metaxas Show. Today you're hearing a special Socrates in the City version of the show drawn from a number of events that I hosted in Oxford, England. Here's more of my conversation with Professor Walter Hooper.
I can't think of anyone else, literally anyone, who's done anything like that. Can you think of anyone who moves in those directions?
I don't think so. I think what Lewis did is he said, what I tried to do in my three cosmic trilogy, the interplanetary stories, was to pull the rug out from under all of the former writers who, when they get to a foreign planet, you always find that we are the good people and everybody else on that planet are monsters. But in his case, he reversed it. We really turn out to be sort of the monsters because they are planets filled with unfallen being. Now, he liked the idea of trying to create an unfallen being. He knew it was very, very difficult. But, I mean, nowhere did he work harder than the Tenedril, the Lady of Perelandra, to try to make her interesting but unfallen.
It's an accomplishment absolutely unparalleled in literature. I cannot think. This is why it seems to me to say that Lewis doesn't get his due is a great understatement. I mean, he has done some things to create. I mean, there are a number of literary images and images that he creates that are peerless. The idea of the floating islands, to do that plausibly. The idea of creating these characters, the Sorns, the Fifeltrigge.
Fifeltrigge.
Gesundheit. Just masterful, absolutely masterful. And yet, it goes so far beyond that. He's doing things that to create an unfallen world and to try to pull that off in a way that doesn't make them sound boring. I mean, even Dante couldn't make the Paradiso interesting or a tenth as interesting as the Inferno. It's very difficult to portray goodness in a way that's interesting. The idea that Lewis could begin to pull it off, you know, puts him in the first rank. I've never heard of anything like it, and I think the world should read Paralandra, as I say, alongside the greatest works in the canon.
Well, he was aware that it's very hard to create good characters. And he discusses this in his preface to Paradise Lost. Why is it so difficult to create good characters? Simply because the bad characters survive in us. All we have to do to create a bad character, he said, is let loose from our own souls and bodies all the itching and horrible thoughts that we are, that are in us waiting, you know, just to get out. But to create better characters, people who are really good, we have to be good ourselves, you know, because you can't express much goodness unless you have a very good idea of it or unless you are yourself good, you know. But anyway, Lewis himself delighted in good, and he was able to create characters who really were good and interesting as well.
Well, it's... maybe as I get sanctified, I'll appreciate the Paradiso more. But it is interesting that at Paradise Lost, everyone says, and it becomes a hackneyed, kind of apocryphal, self-fulfilling half-truth that that Satan is the romantic hero and the compelling figure of Paradise Lost. You hear it over and over and over again, and I think people say it because they sort of want it to be true. There's a truth there. But it shows that you know, Milton, I don't think, had the imaginative power, you know, the horsepower that Lewis had. It is much more difficult to do that. And anyway, we just got a few more moments. The Screwtape Letters... where do you, you said in our previous session that Lewis didn't conceive of this as a book, or at least he didn't write it as a book. He wrote it as a series of letters to be published in the, starts with a C.
Well, it was The Guardian.
Oh, The Guardian.
Not the newspaper. This was a church magazine.
Okay. Where did this idea come from? Was it his idea?
Well, he was actually in church. He writes to Warney in 1941 about being in church and heading to quarry when that occurred to him, the idea of a devil writing letters about temptation. And he said, what a pity that I thought of it in church. But anyway, he did. And so once he thought of it, it just poured out. And you know, over the years, I've seen many, many people have written new Screwtape Letters, so to speak. And, you know, they've all been found really pretty dull. They try to be very, very up to date. But Lewis, in the end, when you read that, you go back to the real Screwtape Letters and you find that what makes them up to date is that they're always universal truths, which he's talking about, like jealousy and worries, you know, the sort of things like, and humility. And he introduces certain things which are very humorous too, like the lady who came to tea, who was not a glutton in the usual sense, but a glutton of delicacy. And I remember Lewis's sort of sister, Lady Dunbar, saying, when we saw that on stage, she said, oh, I remember the woman who came to tea and said, oh no, that's far too much. All I want is just a tiny wee bit of taste. No, that's far too much butter. No, it's just a little tiny bit. And Maureen said she gave us more trouble than if she'd eaten six large cakes, you know.
This is a special Oxford edition of the Eric Metaxas Show. There's more of this conversation with Professor Walter Hooper coming up next. You're listening to a special Socrates in the City edition of the Eric Metaxas Show from Oxford, England. Let's continue my conversation with Professor Walter Hooper.
When I was thinking about writing a contemporary version of the Screwtape letters, I realized that, of course, I can't call it Screwtape or something, so I should come up with something which is maybe an homage, a tip of the hat. But that is in the same spirit. And I was maybe deconstructing the word Screwtape and trying to figure out what Screwtape, why is that so outrageously apt? It's perfect. Screwtape. What is that?
Well, there are two syllables, both of which are really quite ugly to think about.
Yeah. But you think, again, why ugly? Why do we say they're ugly? They are. But what is it about those words, something innate about them? I came up with this. I don't know if anyone's come up with this. As I was deconstructing Wormwood and Screwtape and thinking about these words, I realized that we think of a tapeworm and a wood screw.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's nothing more horrific than a tapeworm, you know, and a wood screw, that's obviously just a screw, but I thought Wormwood Screwtape, the idea that they could be broken apart into tapeworm.
Yeah. He enjoyed, I think, when he was writing it, but he said afterwards, he said, almost by the time I got to Ben, I was almost suffocated by, you know, the story itself about the devils, you know. He said, you know, I mean, it's not something you really enjoy thinking about, you know, putting everything in reverse. So what actually lifted his spirits was occasionally, you see, they talk about the enemy, that's God. And Screwtape, for instance, points out to Wormwood, don't be foolish, he said. We are not the ones who create pleasures. The enemy is the only one who can create a pleasure. What we do is a battle is to turn it around, twist it, so it ceases to be a pleasure. But we can't create anything good. He does that.
You've done so much over the course of now 50 years. How do you want to be remembered?
A few years ago, I went to Bratislava in Slovakia to the C.S. Lewis High School. I stayed there for several days. I gave some talks, but then they like to ask questions. And the last question put to me was by a young girl of about 17, something like that. She said, how does it feel to have lived your whole life under the shadow of someone else? I said, wonderful. I wish I could do it again and again and again. I think I've been the most fortunate man on earth, you know, without writing anything interesting myself, All I push forward is my apostolate, is to push C.S. Lewis, who wrote all the things that I love. And I've been allowed to just keep on celebrating his works and bringing out more and more of them as I find them. So, yes, I've lived under his shadow. What a shadow, though. I love that shadow.
I am beyond grateful, cannot express my gratitude for this on so many levels. Thank you for sharing yourself so freely and tremendously generously. We see it. We appreciate it. So, folks, maybe a final extremely warm round of applause. Thank you for coming to Socrates in the City Oxford Edition.
Folks, you've been listening to a special Socrates in the City event from Oxford, England, and it's my privilege to share these events, these conversations with you, my radio audience. I hope you've been enjoying them. This is a special English version of the Eric Metaxas Show.